Well, good morning. I'm calling to order the House Children, Families, Finance, and Policy Committee. We might actually just barely have a quorum, but in any case, I need to run off to present a bill in another committee. I'll be back after not too long. So we're going to shake things up in the agenda a little bit, and we'll have a presentation of the governor's budget. Vice Chair Keeler handled that. And I did want to note that when I'm back, we will do an important piece of business, which is to welcome a new member, Representative Lawrence. And so we'll have him do that. But I'm going to run off to the other committee and be back shortly and turn things over to Vice Chair Keeler. Thank you so much to all.
Okay, good morning, members. We'll start with just an overview of the governor's supplemental budget review. And I think first up we have Assistant Commissioner Tiki Brown. Is that correct? It's a team effort. You guys just want to introduce yourselves as you go for the record. Thank you.
Hi, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Elise Bailey. I'm the Budget Director for the Department of Human Services. I'm here with my colleague, Assistant Commissioner Tiki Brown. And we're going to go over the governor's budget recommendations today with you. Just starting with our mission, we always like to center the governor's budget really around what our goals and what our goals are for the state and our focus across all of our programs. So DHS, working with many others across the state, we strive to help people meet their basic needs so that they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. Oh, wrong way. This slide just kind of goes over the magnitude of impact across DHS of all of our programs. So across DCYF and DHS programs, we serve about 48% of kids across the state, 27% of adults and parents, 17% of older adults, and 37% of people with disabilities in Minnesota. Of course, we don't do this alone, and so you'll see on this slide all of the people impacted and are part of the human services system, including people served and their families, along with tribal nations, counties, providers, the federal government, you all, and providers. So we, of course, are at a point in time where we had an enormous historic budget last year. And so we're reeling from implementing all those transformative investments. So we just want to make a quick note about what those were. We, of course, made substantial progress in improving our programs across the state and impacting more than 1.5 million people. We took important steps to strengthen the childcare industry, supporting the well-being of kids and stabilizing working families, supporting workforce crises in the home and community-based services sector, and addressing deep poverty and homelessness across the state. We had a focus on improving equitable access to behavioral health and health insurance coverage, particularly around children. And of course, we authorized the Department of Children, Youth, and Families and the Department of Drug Care and Treatment to be their own agencies with the goal to having easier access to comprehensive services and to bolster patient care. This next slide is a summary of our total budget across all of the jurisdictions. So we have 18 proposals across Human Services, Children and Families, and the Health and Human Services jurisdictions. Our budget focuses on critical needs, such as increasing the state's capacity to serve people needing behavioral health care, including children's, deploying strategies to assist people with complex needs to leave hospital care when they no longer need it, reducing opioid overdoses through an 1115 waiver, and increasing access to care for folks exiting correctional facilities, investing in vital infrastructure supporting the child welfare system, and we'll go over that today, developing an agile response to addressing emergency needs across the state and operational needs as our agency reconfigures. The total package across all of DHS is about $47 million in the first biennium and $21 million in the second. In this jurisdiction, the total budget is about $37 million in the first biennium and $25.5 in the second. And with that, we'll go into detail on what is within this jurisdiction and the bill before us.
Sounds good. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. So our first slide here is supporting the child welfare infrastructure. The governor's budget.
I'm going to pause. Can you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, thank you so much. Thanks. For the record, Tiki Brown, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. Thank you.
Go ahead.
All right, our first slide here is supporting the child welfare infrastructure. The governor's budget includes $15 million in one-time state funding to transform the Social Services Information System, or SSIS, to better support positive end-user experiences and the children and families in our child welfare system. This investment provides an initial investment towards total system replacement of SSIS. More will be needed for complete modernization. This proposal unlocks, about $15 million in federal matching funds, and it supports key steps in implementing the recommendations of a vendor assessment, which will include contracting with the software development company and contractors for system redesign, hiring minute maintenance and operations staff, and then purchasing new application technology. Funds were provided during the 2023 session, allowing for DHS and Minute to contract with a vendor who will provide the agencies with both short-term and long-term recommendations. Summer EBT, or Electronic Benefit Transfer Program funding. This recommendation provides administrative funding required to participate in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's new summer EBT program. This investment of $13.6 million in 24 and 25 and $11.5 million in 26 and 27. Beginning in the summer of 2024, summer EBT will provide $120 per child in grocery benefits over the summer to an estimated 400,000 children in Minnesota, making a major impact on food security for families. The age range of students is K through 12. This investment unlocks approximately $50 million in funding annually, or almost $100 million per biennium, with the federal government fully covering the benefit cost. With this funding, Minnesota can implement summer EBT in the summer of 2024 through a partnership with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, the Department of Education, and the federal government. Addressing food security for Minnesotans. Minnesota communities are experiencing record demand for food resources in their communities. This proposal provides critical funding to support food security in our state. It invests $5 million in one-time funds in fiscal year 2025. This recommendation includes $1 million for the American Indian Food Sovereignty Funding Program, $2 million for food shelves under the Minnesota Food Shelf Program, and $2 million for Minnesota's six regional food banks. This recommendation helps meet high demand for food shelves caused by high food prices and the end of pandemic programs like Emergency SNAP. The opioid allocation modifications and sunset elimination is a budget neutral proposal that improves investments in child welfare from the opioid epidemic response account and ensures that resources are available ongoing to support Minnesota communities. This proposal eliminates a sunset on fees collected by opioid manufacturers and distributors to ensure that there is ongoing funding to address the continued escalating detrimental impacts of the opioid crisis. It updates the formula used to distribute child welfare investments to ensure consistency for local communities and to maintain the availability of funds when positive outcomes are seen. The next slide is on weighted risk systems for licensed childcare. This proposal implements a new tiered weighted risk system to evaluate licensing compliance for childcare centers and for family childcare providers. This new system replaces Minnesota's childcare fix-it tickets under 245.065. It provides a tiered enforcement framework that is weighted to reflect the level of risk for each childcare licensing regulation. It promotes consistency by standardizing the enforcement of licensing rules throughout the state. It prioritizes resources for providers who need assistance and support most by tiering regulation violations by risk level, and it reflects work between the department and community partners to modernize child care licensing. Transition to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. The government's, technical and federal compliance proposals. This proposal will invest $508,000 in federal fiscal year 25 and $939,000 in fiscal year 26 and 27 to implement and ensure compliance with federal laws and regulations due to the recent changes to SNAP and TANF that were passed as part of the federal debt ceiling agreement to ensure compliance with federal laws regarding labor, labor trafficking of youth and missing children. This investment supports changes to the SSIS system or the Social Services Information System to comply with federal requirements that labor trafficking of youth receive a response from the child welfare system. In addition, the investment supports changes to the MAXIS eligibility system to raise the age at which adults without dependents may be exempted from SNAP work requirements from 49 to 54. It exempts veterans, people experiencing homelessness, and former foster youth under the age of 25 from SNAP work requirements. In addition to system costs, this proposal includes four FTEs to provide technical assistance to counties and tribal nations to implement new SNAP policies and procedures. And it adds additional support for adapting the reporting to compensate for workarounds that will be used until changes can be made in our MAXIS computer system.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. And Commissioner Brown, are you the one continuing?
I am. Thank you.
Okay, please.
Okay. This proposal also has a budget bill technical cleanup on page 72, which makes technical changes to ensure that DHS can carry out policy changes approved by the 2023 legislature. It fixes critical errors, carry forward amounts, effective dates, and offers technical changes. It is a budget neutral addition. All right, thank you. All right, so next we'll move to the transition to the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families. The governor's supplemental budget includes $2 million in 24 and 25 and $12 million in 26 and 27 for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families and originating agencies. It ensures that resources for a strong team at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families and ensuring thriving agencies. It provides investments in critical operation capacity for DCYF necessary to be responsive to legislative recommendations and community feedback for partnership and navigation. The governor's recommendations include two parts. I'll be joined by Ashley Reisenhauer, Director of Budget Policy and Analysis at Minnesota Management and Budget, who talk about central operations and critical gap analyses that inform this request.
Thank you so much. I think we're going to pause. I think there may be a question or
sure.
two before we move on. So Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you. Part of it, too, is I want to ask my question before I have to go to present
All
a
right.
bill. And we have had a lot of conversations around the food insecurity piece. And I know we have a follow-up plan around it, too. But I think one of the things is in this committee, we've spent a lot of time talking about SNAP as our approach to address food insecurities. Of Minnesotans all ages, you know, that included our seniors, our higher education, individuals to help support, you know, applying in the process. And then this comes in with a very high request for the EBT summer program, which is really only focused on our K-12 individuals, and then looks like a pretty small amount towards food insecurities towards the rest of Minnesota. When you look at the breakdown of numbers, it just seems a little bit uneven. So can you kind of walk us through, you know, I think earlier in this committee, I made a statement that it feels really, I have some concerns about moving food insecurities and homelessness over to DCYF because I was nervous that what would happen is we would focus more on children in that lane versus the entire individual of Minnesotans. And this kind of is an example of what I was nervous about is because a huge chunk of your food insecurities is going towards children that are kindergarten incoming kindergartners to 12th grade, and not a lot of money left over for the rest of Minnesota. And so can you kind of share your approach to that and kind of how maybe that offsets some of the concerns that I have, because it looks a little bit concerning to me.
Commissioner.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Vice Chair and members. Summer EBT is a program that is a brand new program available through the federal government, and it allows for benefits to be placed on an EBT card. And that EBT card allows families to make the choices that they would like to make in terms of purchasing food from their local grocery stores or online to be delivered to their homes. One of the benefits of summer EBT is, although it is absolutely focused towards this population of children, incoming kindergartners, and through 12th grade, it is a benefit for the whole entire family. Parents, grandparents, any family member that has a child in their household will benefit from this program. And so while it is the eligibility criteria is really focused on children, in fact, it benefits the whole entire family.
Vice Chair Keeler.
I would just add that, again, we have adults with no dependents. We have seniors that don't have little kids in their homes anymore. So I just on the record, I think we want to acknowledge that what the governor sent us is really missing addressing food insecurities for the entire person of the individuals who live in Minnesota. So that's all I have to say, and we'll follow up with that, I'm sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. And then we will move on then, unless folks have anything right now. In general, if there are broader questions, we want to save them, but I know some folks may need to leave to other things. So I guess we'll continue with the presentation then with, I think, Ms. Was it Rice? I'm sorry. Well, I guess I'll confirm your last name once you sit down and identify yourself. And please, yeah, identify yourself and then proceed.
I'm Ashley Reisnauer. I'm a Director of Budget Policy and Analysis for Health and Human Services and Housing at Minnesota Management and Budget.
Please proceed. Oh, Commissioner, okay.
If that's okay, I'll say a few more slides before I pass it over to Ashley.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see here. So slide 12. All right. So the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, as you all know, is a bold opportunity to realign state government to better serve children and families. The supplemental budget proposal is the work of last year's legislative session. It builds upon the work of last year's legislative session to implement priority investments at the new agency and ensure that all impacted agencies can continue to deliver high quality services. All right, so this budget request is distinct from what was funded during the DCYF establishing legislation, which is a one-time funding for the two-year transition and planning process. The only ongoing resources appropriated last year were for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families executive team, with amounts available on the slide. Based on the legislative recommendations and community feedback, the supplemental budget proposal includes leadership roles to support stronger relationships with counties and tribes, family navigation, and coordination of services for children who have disabilities and children's mental health. Specifically, heard through engagement was the need for more focused leadership in tribal relations and consultation and improved coordination in improved coordinated relationships with tribal programs. We've gathered specific feedback from other states and continue to build relationships through the transition process. The DCYF establishing legislation directed the administration to develop a specific structure for partnerships with tribes and counties. Based on our engagement and consultation with tribes and ongoing partnership and dialogue with the counties, the governor is recommending establishing and managing an intergovernmental advisory committee and investing in ongoing county and tribal engagement. This model is similar to the State Community Health Services Advisory Committee, which is housed at the Department of Health. This proposal also includes coordinating enterprise programs for children who have disabilities and children's mental health, and creating resources to begin a pilot and launch a family navigation team that could work with engagement and programs across state-level programs and systems. Next, we will describe the larger portion of the proposal that addresses critical gaps in central operation functions at the Department of Children, Youth, and Families and the originating agencies as identified through proportional analyses. I will hand the presentation over now to Ashley Reisenhauer from the Director of Budget Policy and Analysis at Minnesota Management and Budget.
Okay, Director Reisenhauer, I'm glad to have you with us. You had identified yourself before, so please continue.
Good morning. Thank you. As Assistant Commissioner Brown mentioned, the enabling DCYF legislation funded a two-year planning process and some specific one-time costs, such as upgrading a cost allocation system. The only ongoing costs were for the executive team, but it articulated a need for ongoing research and need to be done to identify those specific critical gaps and resource needs. So the DCYF legislation does direct that a proportional amount of the base and resources supporting DCYF programs transferring from originating agencies, but it doesn't name or quantify those. Since the end of the 2023 session, MMB budget analysts and finance teams at the Departments of Human Services and Education have been working to really dig into the details about how to operationalize that proportional transfer. The Implementation Office has also been working in partnership to understand how, when, and where those teams can transition and where there might be critical gaps that impact agency and program functions. So this proposal is really the result of all of that work. As seen on the slides, to start with, we identified the total resources needed for central operations at DCYF. So this included building a staffing model with agency experts in central operations areas, things like finance, compliance, human resources. We also conducted evaluation and interviews across comparable state agencies. Our next step was looking at resources that are available to transfer. So this started by identifying the proportional resources that are used to administer programs that will be moving to the new DCYF. Then we analyzed what are the critical gaps and impacts if those proportional resources are transferred from current agencies. The analysis included plans to restructure teams, to redistribute work in response to the newly sized functions. It also looked at opportunities for short-term and long-term interagency agreements to share across agencies. Only the critical gaps that could not be addressed through one of those options were considered for this proposal. So the difference between those total resources needed and those available to transfer is what's included in the proposal. It represents those gaps that, if left unresolved, will have impacts on program administration, financial functions, and external relationships of DCYF and impacted agencies. Based on that research, it's estimated that DCYF will need about 173 FTEs in their central operations for performing things like finance, human resources, contracts, and grants management. The staffing model also accounts for some of the very unique characteristics of DCYF, including that it'll have the third largest general fund budget among state agencies. It has an exceptionally large grant portfolio and needs to be responsive to different levels of governance, partners, and people who access its services. The model represents about 19% of total agency FTE, which is well within the range of 15 to 23% found at comparable state agencies. So while the organizational analysis determined the total level of resources needed for central operations at DCYF, and the DCYF enabling legislation requires current agencies to transfer proportional resources supporting DCYF programs. So as a result, the majority of those 173 FTE will be provided by transferring proportional resources from current agencies as well as the executive positions that were funded last session. So about 137 of those 173 FTE are already funded. The proposal, though, addresses the remaining needs at DCYF and current agencies after those proportional transfers happen. At DCYF, this includes 36 FTE to support functions like finance, contracts, and grants. It's the needed investment to make sure that they have things like a responsive grant system and processes. It also includes 15-minute FTE for developing and implementing systems and data architecture that's specific to the DCYF. And then it addresses critical gaps that would be left to the Departments of Human Services and Departments of Education after those proportional resources are transferred. So as I mentioned earlier, agencies are planning to restructure and redistribute work in response to newly sized functions. They're leveraging opportunities for interagency agreements, but there were some critical gaps that couldn't be addressed through those. For example, the DCYF legislation requires a proportional transfer of resources. In some cases, that means that only a portion of a position's funding would be transferring because the person only spends a fraction of their time supporting DCYF. Moving that funding leaves a gap at the agency that needs to be addressed. There are also some functions that are done by a very small number of staff and can't easily be shared. So the recommendation makes sure that both DCYF and the originating agency have the staff that they need to continue those functions. So addressing those gaps requires about 19.5 FTE at DHS and about 2.6 at MDE. And those address those critical gaps needed to avoid disruptions in services provided by DHS and MDE as programs begin shifting to the new agency. So thank you for allowing us to describe the very careful planning during the transition period and those resources needed for DCYF ongoing.
Thank you so much, Director Reisenhower. It looks like, Commissioner Brown, anything else before we move to questions?
Nothing more from me. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. Let me think. So a couple things, members. The change pages regarding these proposals are in your packets, as I understand it. So we have that. I think what we'll do is have some member questions about this. We have not moved the bill yet, and I do want to make sure to provide public testimony at this around the way as well. So I think what I'll do is if there are questions or discussion folks want to have right now, but otherwise we'll do that formal process and then certainly get back to member discussion and questions as well. Let me just ask Representative Hicks, do you want to ask something now? We are going to be moving the bill and offering opportunity for any public testimony. We could do that, and then you're first on the list, or if you want to ask something right now, you can. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for explaining all of these pieces. I do want to just say thank you from the bottom of my heart around the coordination of services for children with disabilities and children's mental health services. Yesterday in Human Resources, we had an information, or Human Resources, Human Services, it's been a day. We had an informational hearing about the children that are out of state in getting mental health treatment. The numbers are just very unfortunate. The lack of the ability for the department to have the data and all the caveats that were shared was very eye-opening. And really the need for services and supports across the spectrum was highlighted. And so I don't think we can build that system without having really targeted work to coordinate those things across the agencies. So I want to say thank you so much for highlighting that and for investing in that. And I'm grateful that we will have some priority and focus in that area.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representatives Coulter and Zlesnikar, you're next up. Oh, same offer to you. We could move the bill and do public testimony and then resume member discussion, but if there's something you want to say or ask now, you'll do that. Representatives Zlesnikar, are you okay waiting for that as well? Okay. All right. Then in that case, what I'm going to do is maybe I'll ask Representative Katizwa-Tune if you'll move House File 5267 to bring that before us.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. And then, members, there is the A24 amendment, which I think there were a couple of riders that were missing from it's the A24 amendment to kind of add in those pieces. It was discussed in the presentation. These relate to food security. So Representative Katizwa-Tune, if you'll move the A24 amendment.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I should have noted that we do in fact have a quorum. That was something I should have noted before starting all this, but we certainly have had one for a while. Any discussion of the A24? Not hearing any. All in favor of approval of the A24, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. The bill is amended. And there are no additional testifiers signing up in advance, but anyone who wishes to testify on this bill, which is really the governor's budget proposal in the human services area, please make your way up. I don't know if there is. I kind of thought that there was somebody, but perhaps not. All right. I think there may be information in our packets with some public input as well. Oh yeah, a couple letters. So, all right. Well, so that we're, there we go. So now moving back to member discussion, Representative Coulter, you were next up on the list.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have just a few questions about the weighted risk system. And I first of all want to say that I'm really glad that we are moving away from the fix-it ticket system. This is something that I've heard pretty consistently from providers that we do need to change. So I just sort of, first of all, question of clarity on the language. So the weighted risk system, the language in the bill repeals the current section of the statute that contains the fix-it ticket system. So if and when this becomes law, then sort of immediately this weighted risk system takes the place of the fix-it ticket system. I'm also glad we're getting rid of it, because that's not an easy phrase to say.
No, bit of a tongue twister. Yeah.
So am I correct in sort of there's that sort of seamless transition? There's the fix-it ticket system now, and then immediately the weighted risk system.
And if you could work in the phrase fix-it ticket system repeatedly in the answer, that'd be great.
At least three times.
Three times. Yeah. Okay. Ms. Bailey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
That's good.
Just a few more questions here. So, currently, correction orders are, as I understand it, they are not appealable. That is to say that these are sort of internal decisions within the department, that there is no process for appeal to say, an ALJ or anything beyond that? Am I correct in that?
Director Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to phone a friend.
Yeah, I can imagine that's probably in somebody else's area of expertise. Let's see who's coming up. Looks like Mr. Hosh. And once you get settled in, if you just identify yourself and then proceed. Glad to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry Hosh, Manager, Office of Inspector General Policy. Representative Coulter, for correction orders, a reconsideration process can be undertaken. It's not a process of going to an administrative law judge, but you can have reconsideration.
Representative Coulter.
And thank you for that clarification. And that is an internal process within the department, correct?
Mr. Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter, correct.
Thank you.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my understanding then is that would not, with the implementation of the weighted risk system, that would not change, correct? That correction orders would continue to be, would not have that appeals process anymore.
Mr. Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter, with the rated risk system, we would have documented technical assistance for low risk violations, which kind of mirror what the fix-it ticket process was. There would still be correction orders for standard violations and potentially negative licensing actions on high-risk violations.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification here. And I guess sort of the reason that I'm bringing this up is that my worry is that with the new weighted risk system that, again, I do absolutely believe we need to implement, with the current correction order system, that we are in essence sort of creating a two-tiered system where, it sort of allows the department to not dismiss, but sort of, I can't think of a better word, but dismiss some lower level violations, but not others. And I'm just a little bit concerned about that being an entirely internal process, particularly when we're thinking about these correction orders, because these are obviously the kinds of things that can make or break a provider and make the difference between them staying open and not. And so I guess I would just, as things move forward, I'd just encourage the department to consider some kind of sort of external appeals process, just to sort of make sure that we satisfy due process, that our providers are being taken care of. So
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We will keep moving then. Representative Zlesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I appreciate that $15 million has been allocated, from my understanding, for the IT, for the SSIS system. I guess my concern is, from listening to previous testimony, if I understood it right, the system costs like $80 to $100 million. And so I'm curious as to the time frame. At what point will this system be installed, fully funded? Is there a strategic plan for that from the department?
Director Bailey or Commissioner, I'm not sure who the right person is. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'll take that one. So you're correct. The initial estimates that we have seen from other states and received from our conversations with other vendors are that, in fact, it may take $80 to $100 million to completely replace the system. Our $2 million investment last year took us a step forward in some of the research and technical assessment and determining the user experience needs for the SSIS system. This proposal does take us one more step forward in more incremental fashion. That does not, in fact, move us towards a complete overhaul. However, we do think, given the large investment, it does make sense to take varying steps along the way to help stabilize the system and make some efforts to improve it in the meantime. We have a vendor that we will be, we have a request for a proposal right now for a vendor that we will have a report due this summer. And so we'll have, based on that information, a much more strategic plan in terms of the timing and the actual amount of dollars that it will take to replace the system in Minnesota.
And maybe I can just clarify before sending it back. My understanding is $80 to $100 million, of which we would expect a 50% federal participation, so it would be $40 to $50 million in terms of state cost.
Thank you.
Okay, I just want to make sure to be clear on that. Representative Zlesnikar, back to you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that information. I guess I'm very concerned. March 29th, the Star and Tribune did an article on the impact for counties, and there's tremendous testimony in that article that talks about the turnover. 40 to 50% of county casework turnover is related to the primary reason is, guess what, SSIS. And the secondary reason is SSIS. So while we put $20 million, I believe, to create this new department, we have not created the fundamental horse, which is needed to do the maltreatment systems. We have no ability to do simple things like copy and paste. So the information is being tremendous labor intensive. It's created an environment for that. So I appreciate all the initiatives and support the initiatives that you're doing. I just have a serious concern, and I think this committee needs to. We are not going to be able to deliver because the maltreatment reports, the out-of-home placements, adult, child, mental health, services to elderly and people with disabilities all run through SSIS. And then we have MMIS that deals with the healthcare side. And both of them are antiquated systems. So we haven't even addressed that, and we don't have a plan to address that. And this committee has to seriously address that. So the initiatives are great, but if we don't have the ability in 2024 to have the infrastructure, I don't see how we're moving Minnesota forward. And that's, I'm going to say that for every time I can, because I am getting bombarded by people in the counties. St. Louis County is the biggest county in the state. And we are handicapping people to be able to serve the people we are all here to represent. And especially in greater Minnesota, when you need the technology to communicate and you're in the field and your drive time to get back to a computer to do this, we are all here on our phones communicating. And we are not setting up our people in government and state offices and counties to do their jobs. And I just want it to be noted on the record, I'm extremely disappointed that we are adding carts without the horse. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loznikar. Representative Nelson, to you.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And I guess I will say on the, you know, the SSIS system, thank you for the $15 million request for it. However, I think I will echo much of the concerns that Representative Loznikar said is, you know, it's a big system, it's complex, and I think compartmentalizing and changing some things as a step is important. You know, there's I think 30-some different programs that are run underneath of it, and I think, you know, maybe focusing on the children part of it is maybe the best step, you know, initially. But I just, you know, I know we don't have a great budget right now. At the same time, I worry we're not spending enough on this and making sure that we're really doing this system the justice that we need to. You know, this was rolled out in 1999. That's 25 years ago. It's a little bit hard to believe. But you know, some of the computers that are still required in the SSIS system, you can play Oregon Trail on it, you know. And so I don't know, you know, I mean, this is a little bit outdated here. And, you know, to think of how the, you know, computing technology has changed, you know, is badly needed. And I think it's a little bit of an embarrassment on the state that we haven't addressed it before this. But I am thankful that it is being addressed, and I think if there's any way we can find in the couch cushions some additional resources to be able to make a bigger impact on the SSIS system. But, you know, thank you for your work on this, and I think it's something that we need to continue to work on because our social workers are really frustrated with the system, and many of them are not doing the work that they want to be with the actual children and the families that they're there to serve. And, you know, they're frustrated with the technology that they're being required to use. So, you know, thank you for the investment, but at the same time, Chair Pinto, I would ask if there's any way we can find any more, let's do that.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Katizutun, you're up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to echo the frustration and the concerns of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle. I mean, this is something that we've been talking about all session. We've been talking about this for years. And I want to acknowledge the frustration that the department currently has with the system. It is not that you think everything is unicorns and rainbows. I mean, I know that you know your staff and the counties are struggling under the weight of this system. And this is not a problem that happened overnight. It didn't happen from 2023 to 2024. It didn't happen from 2017 to 2018. 25 years we've been working. And these changes, the leaps and bounds that technology does overnight sometimes is just really hard to keep up with. So, I mean, acknowledging that this has been a struggle, this is not something that we are going to be able to fix overnight, because setting up a system for success for the future takes time. But I think it's really important, the report that's being requested, that we can really set out a positive pathway for success is going to help us revolutionize, hopefully, the services that we're providing for people. And, you know, this is something that people are struggling with across the state. It was actually an SD49 resident who invented Oregon Trail, so I appreciate that shout out there. It was one of my favorite games in my childhood.
That's a deep cut constituent call out there, Representative Katiza with tune. Like, there you go.
Hey,
yeah,
impressive. I digress.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, we know that social workers and county social workers across the state go in, they log in, they put in the most comprehensive report that they can based on their conversations and their meetings and all the work that they're doing to support families. And then if the system doesn't save it, then they have to go back in, and it's probably a summary of that first report. So we know that we're not getting the best information. As one of two Hennepin County representatives on the committee, I just want to point out that, you know, 22% of the state's population resides in Hennepin County. So I know very well the struggles of the caseworkers in Hennepin County, here in the largest county in the state, population-wise. So I think that it's something that we do need to continue talking about, but I want to recognize that these concerns are not just from the minority or from the majority. I mean, these are not things that the agency is ignoring, and I appreciate the work and time that you guys have put in and come here to talk to us about, so that we can, going forward, make this work better for everybody.
Thank you so much, Representative Katiza-Witoon. Looking to see if there's other discussion or questions the folks may have. Vice Chair Keeler, certainly.
Thank you, Chair. I do just want to follow up on the SSIS. I think we've all said it, right? There's like mass frustration around it, and we need to work. But when it comes to choosing the vendor, and I was trying to look through the language to see if it's in there, but one thing that we learned with the vendor for background checks is there is this like domino effect that the vendor that does background checks is actually based out of the United States. And so is there comfort language, or actually not comfort language, real language, that we can put in this to make sure that whatever vendor we choose to help build a system to keep all the information on our children is not being like, doesn't have the steps that it ends up out of our United States borders. I think it's just really important. And we see how many issues we have with background studies here. Not that I can tie those things together, but I think it does create a different issue for us to hold a vendor accountable when we see that happen. So if it's in here, I'm sorry I couldn't find it, but I just wanted to also make sure that we have that on the record, that we can make sure that that is some language that's in here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and if there's certainly Commissioner or Director Bailey, if you have anything to say about any of these things, feel free to do so. I think we may be done with member discussion or questions at this point. So Commissioner will allow you to say anything that you wish, or Director Bailey, about any of this.
I'll just make a quick note that I appreciate the call out about the vendor, and while I don't have that at the tip of my fingertips, I will make sure that that language is part of our vendor selection or part of our contract process with the vendor. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, good. Another note, members, this has been the presentation flowing through our human services side of our budget, which includes the Department of Children, Youth, and Families side. We will receive a presentation on the education side. There's no target in that area. We don't have a net, you know, positive spending that we are able to do. So there's just a few sort of cost-free items. And so that'll happen next week. as part of our budget bill because the MD staff are tied up today and we just sort of couldn't make that work. And again, that's not, there's not additional, there's no positive target there. So just to kind of have folks be oriented. So seeing if there's anything else, doesn't appear that there is. So thank you so much to the testifiers and to everybody who's working for these agencies, how incredibly hard you're working. And with that, the chair lays over House File 5267 as amended for possible inclusion in a budget bill. Thank you so much. So a little bit of, now that we had that quorum, a bit of business to do, members. The very first thing, exactly right, is that we need to introduce, have our new member of the House, new member of the committee, introduce themselves. Representative Lawrence, so glad to have you. You could describe whatever you want about yourself, your district, and any kind of connection you may have with this work. Representative Lawrence.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Lawrence, and I am honored to be the newest elected representative to the House.
And actually, Representative Lawrence is exactly right. The very first correction we're going to give to you is make sure that microphone is right in front of your mouth.
Is that better?
You're a politician now. You want to make sure that it picks up what you have to say.
That's your word. And just honored to be here. And I represent House District 27B, which includes, and I'm just going to see the couple big cities, Princeton, Zimmerman, and St. Francis. That's kind of the general area that that I have the opportunity to represent. I grew up, live in that area with my wife of 28 years. Four children have been raised there as well. Two are married. One's getting married at the end of May here as well. I have an opportunity to work in a family farming business with my mother and brother as well. And that's been my employment, my lifetime employment, I should say, at that point in time. Had a chance to serve on a township supervisor for over 20 years, so I come with a little bit of background to local government and involvement on that level as well. And just humbled and honored that the constituents of House District 27B elected me to come down here and represent them on the state level. So I'm learning. I'm 5 days in. So here we go.
Oh yeah, welcome to you. Glad to have you. And you've got that 20 years of township supervisor experience, so you had that public service experience bringing into this. So welcome, and please don't hesitate to reach out as you're kind of thinking things through and understanding things. And you've got, I mentioned you before, Mr. Withers, who supports your side of the aisle in terms of research, does incredible work, and you'll keep in touch with him and in touch with all of us as well. So glad. And I will note, we've got incredible nonpartisan staff here in the House in general, but this committee in particular, and so certainly be reaching out to them as well. So welcome to you.
Thank you.
We have a couple of sets of minutes to approve. Need to find them. I've got them someplace. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of our March 21st meeting?
So approved.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Keeler. Any additions or corrections to those minutes, members? Not hearing any. All in favor of approval of the March 21 minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the motion passes. And the March 26 minutes, you want to do the same thing, Madam Vice Chair?
Will do. So moved.
Okay, Vice Chair Keeler moves approval of the March 26th minutes. Any additions or corrections, members? And hearing none, then all in favor of approval of the March 26th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, that motion passes. We have gotten some good work done here. And then another agenda item, the final bill on the agenda, 5021, Representative Edelson had said that she wishes to have that bill not advance at this point, and so that bill will not be heard today and will not be on the agenda. And then we are, I think, still waiting to hear from Representative Hassan and verifying some things about that. So the only one left then, for now anyway, is mine, or the one that's available. So I will head up, and Vice Chair Keeler will take over again. House File 4727, I'll make my way up. And so, Madam Chair, if I may, I'll move House File 4727 to bring that before the committee. It's got a cost, so it'll need to just stay here.
Sure. And then I see you have a DE4 amendment. Do you want to review the amendment for us before we vote on it?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I do move the DE4. And members, the DE4 converts the bill. The bill was introduced as a Child Protection Advisory Council with a number of components, but in conversation with the courts, especially not just the courts, a number of stakeholders, it seemed to make the most sense to put this child protection reform work in, to house it in the courts and in the Supreme Court in particular, though, as you'll see in the DE4, with representation from all kinds of perspectives. And so ask members' support to put the bill in that form.
Sounds good. Any member questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The amendment is attached, so we have House File 4727 as amended in front of us. Go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. So members, folks are aware of there being increased attention and really warranted attention on our child protection system, make sure that it's working as well as it possibly can for kids and for families and for all of us. We've previously heard several bills, in fact, had conversations about, of course, the SSIS system, which we just talked about quite a bit, fatality reviews. This bill would establish a process really, I found it challenging as chair of this committee to be getting good ideas about how child protection should be improved. That we have not received that many proposals, and we know that it's a system that certainly can be and needs to be improved. So as I said, in discussion with a number of folks, this idea of having an 18-month process was developed. You'll see a letter in the packet from Chief Justice Hudson endorsing, saying that she's supportive of the bill and the courts are supportive as well. Of course, the courts being an independent branch, we can't tell them what to do. We can invite them to do so. But Chief Justice Hudson is saying, yes, we're on board for this. And this, to my mind, is kind of our main engine for getting us to a place to have a better process for improving this really, really important system. So I do have a testifier with me, Madam Chair, as well, that I'd love to have her speak.
Go ahead, if the testifier can come down. Hi. I'm going to introduce yourself for the record and continue.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Dr. Tracy Laliberty, and I run a research and training center at the University of Minnesota called the Center for Advanced Studies in Child Welfare. So thank you for allowing me to come and speak about House File 4727 today. It's a pretty straightforward bill, so I'll keep my remarks brief. As many of you know, in 2014 and 15, then-Governor Mark Dayton issued an order to create a task force on the protection of children following the death of 6-year-old Eric Dean. At the time, and I'd argue still today, there was considerable conflict among advocates and professionals in the field as to what constitutes best practice in child welfare, practices to ensure child safety, and how to address the burgeoning racial disparities that we have in Minnesota. The governor's task force was charged with examining and making reform recommendations for what is referred to as the front end of the system, as well as the child fatality review process. Some might wonder why we would need an additional body to re-examine the child welfare system and take the approach that the bill takes that is in front of you today. After all, we had a task force followed by years of reform, implementation, and then ongoing, albeit somewhat intermittent, the convening of the legislative child welfare task force. I have four insights to share with you related to the creation of this advisory council in HF 4727, with accountability and responsibility resting in the judicial branch. First, it's been 10 years since a multidisciplinary and community-informed body has convened to examine the child welfare system. Much has happened in that time, and examination every decade or so is warranted when the stakes of individuals, families, and communities are so high. We have much to gain from an examination and a critical analysis of our involuntary systems, particularly complex systems such as child protection. Second, HF 4727 proposes to examine the full scope of child protection, of the child protection system, while the 2015 task force examined only part. Again, it was the front end of the system. Areas needing critical examination and improvement extend across child protection, the child protection continuum, and are not centralized to the front end of the system. An example of that might be the high rates of foster care reentry. A third area of merit for HF 4727 is its positioning within the judicial branch of government. We've seen across the country that when advisory groups such as this are convened, their success is marked by the ability and the authority to affect actual change and impact accountability pathways. Numerous areas of examination by this body will lie within the court's jurisdiction. Having judicial engagement at the leadership level will be important. That said, I make that observation with some caveats. Much of the services provided by the child protection system are not delivered with court engagement or oversight, and it will be essential that programmatic insights and leadership from within service delivery areas have key roles in leadership as well. We have seen data reflect that the more families are engaged in court-related activities, the longer they remain and the deeper into the legal system they go. For example, termination of parental rights. Caution must accompany this body so that all aspects of child protection are not seen through the single lens of the judiciary, but rather from multiple perspectives, including that of communities, people with lived experience, in order to employ consideration of the many, many possibilities of intervention. The fourth and final area that I will comment on is the construct of time. While the task force of 2014-2015 was given just 6 months to complete their work, the proposed advisory council will have 16 months, nearly an extra year. This extended time frame is essential to being able to complete the work outlined in this bill. I would hazard a guess that the council will be quite challenged, in fact, to get it done in this time frame, given the comprehensive look at this very complex system. Defining and operationalizing the scope of the council's work will perhaps be the most critical element of their work overall. To this point, as an example, I would argue that the examination of the child welfare system is quite different than the examination of the child protection system, and that these terms are far more than semantics. Having enough members in order to conduct work group activity will be important without becoming overly populated and unwieldy. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, and it's good to see you here. Yeah. Chair Pinto, did you have anybody else to testify?
No, none for me, Madam
Chair. Any members from the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Pinto, for bringing this bill. I think it's an idea whose time has come. Certainly some of the most lengthy conversations that I've had with folks have been around the child protection services space. And so my question is how accessible is this process going to be for the public? I think that a lot of times when somebody comes to me with a story, and it's always a story, and there's always a lot of nuances to it, what I tell them is, well, what we need to do is sit down and figure out, like, the nuts and bolts of where the problem is and develop some sort of proposal, legislative solution to fix whatever the issue is. And it sounds like that's what the purpose of this council is, in a more comprehensive way. So would it be something that we could refer such people to and say, go talk to this council, offer your testimony, so that as they're considering their kind of comprehensive fix to the system, that those sorts of anecdotes can be incorporated into the process?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Hudson, for the really, that's a really good question and thoughtful. And I guess what I'm, so yes, absolutely, I'm direct your attention to line 2.27, 2.28, that one of the duties is to consult with individuals with lived experience in the system, in addition to having representation on the council from folks with lived experience, but that actually consulting with such individuals is important. You'll note that those lines include, you know, surveys and focus groups, but then also just say including consultation with. So folks providing their input to this will be really important, having Minnesotans do so. That's a great point and something that I think is important for this to do.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Keeler, and thank you for bringing this bill. I think it's an important bill, and I like that the members on this have experience in the system as either a parent or a guardian, and also somebody that's went through child protection type situations to bring that feedback back to the committee. I think as we gather data, I think the data portion for this council is going to also tie back to our previous conversations of this IT system. That concerns me, of how we're going to get data that the council might need to bring forth the information to this legislative body. And so that just is a word I circled, because gathering data is going to be an important role, it looks to me, for the council. But the initiative is overdue and very well founded. I just think it comes us back to that question of how we're going to get the data we need to protect children. So thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Pinto.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Representative Zalesnikar. Having that data is really important, so we need to keep an eye on that. Thank you.
Maybe they'll come back and tell us the SSIS system needs help too, because it seems to be the common narrative of everybody. But I do think that we need to continue to highlight that. Any other members? I'll just add, I do have a couple questions that I do just want to add more for like understanding of a council. So 1.12 and 1.13 talks about the members of the legislature. So it's the first time that I've seen where it's just one appointment from the House and one appointment from the Senate, which only makes me nervous because we're a two-party system. And does that mean, like, in my mind, it should be two members from the House, two members from the Senate, so that we're all able to be at the table? Is that intentional, or can somebody walk me through that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So actually, it's not. It's actually one member from the majority appointed by the Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader, one member appointed by the Minority Leader of the House or the Senate Minority Leader. So actually, in practice, the way this would work is it would be one member from the majority party, one member from the minority party. And I agree that I feel like I've more commonly seen four, and I'm trying to remember, I'm not sure if Ms. Sunderman remembers, like, I feel like this is modeled on other examples where there have been only two, but I may be wrong about that. I'm not sure if Ms. Sunderman can help, Madam Chair, if you're okay with that.
Go ahead, Ms. Sunderman.
Madam Chair, members, I believe this decision was made so the council didn't get too big, because if there were four members of the legislature, that would significantly increase the size of the council. That was a choice made by the author and the advocates.
Rep. Hansen, did you have something you wanted to follow up on this about?
Just another question.
Okay. That's fine. I just kind of wanted to bring it to our attention. I feel like for me, I just need to have some better understanding of that piece. I understand the size. I just think we come to this with maybe different perspectives that are valuable for us all to have in this process. So there's that. The other thing is the line below that when we talk about representation from tribes. Are we making sure that it's tribal courts? Because I think, you know, our tribal nations and our tribal courts, if there's, what is your intention maybe from that representation lane?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm trying now to recall. I'm not sure if Ms. Sunderman can help me, because we definitely had this line at the direction, and I'm trying to remember exactly where, but it was not something that sort of I came up with. And so I may need to look in my notes, remind myself about that, about exactly what and who was contemplated. I will say, I don't know if Ms. Sunderman happens to remember that, but otherwise I may need to get back to you on that before we would finalize this.
Madam Chair, members, I believe, I don't recall whether there was a specific decision as to whether it would be tribal courts or not. I think part of the goal of some of the membership language was to keep some level of flexibility for the appointing authority.
I would just add it. I would say add that as an option, and then you know where I'm going with this, right? Is that we have somebody at the table with deep knowledge and understanding of how ICWA is implemented in the crosshairs of our tribal courts and our state Supreme Court. So that's all I'm trying to make sure that we address and clean up and make very clear, Chair.
And Madam Chair, if I may just note on that, the rest of these lines are all, you'll note, kind of general. It says members representing Indian tribes appointed by MIAC. And so I think the thought is that sort of MIAC has the ability to kind of say, here's what we want from tribal courts, or we want from tribal social services. It's quite flexible. It may well, I totally get your point, and so we can continue talking about maybe making a reference to tribal courts in particular. I think my thinking was that my act sort of has the flexibility to go in any direction for tribal representation. But yeah, happy to continue talking with you, Chair, about that.
Great. Thank you, Chair. Any other questions? Rep Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Pinto, for bringing this bill forward. I just have a question about, I just want to understand that, like, the kind of overall goal of this. Mm-hmm. Is this, to put it simply, is this more of a goal to address prevention or reflection?
Mm. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel like I get what you're saying with prevention. I maybe need to have you explain to me reflection. I feel like I'm confused.
Rep Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And I was trying to be short because I know we're short on time. But I'm trying to think, is the goal of this to look forward or look backwards? Because if we look at the kids that end up in our system, you know, we know that there's too many. We know there's disproportionate outcomes. We know SSIS is causing all these issues. And we can agree, I think, on this committee at least, that SSIS does perpetuate a lot of the problems that we see with kids coming through the system and the failure to support in the ways that we need. And so my concern is that I don't want to see this putting more people into our child protection system, knowing that it doesn't have the tools it needs to really support it as best it could, but also want to make sure that we are addressing, you know, some of the things like poverty and disparity. Like, what kind of upstream approaches, I guess, maybe that's a better way to put the question, could we expect this council to put together? Because I do see on like line 3.22 and 3.23 to work with DHS to evaluate child protection grants to address disparities in child welfare. But what about disparities for like the kids that are staying in the system that we're not able to help right now? Is that a disparity that we're going to address? Yeah.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm actually going to direct this, if I may, to Dr. Laliberti, the actual expert here, for some thoughts.
Dr. Laliberti, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you raised many interesting points in what you said. I don't think that there's agreement that I don't think there's widespread agreement that there's too many kids in the system or that the right kids are being seen by the system. So that's the first thing that I think that this body, depending upon the composition of this body, are going to look at is, are we getting the right kids and families the services that they need, and are kids truly being assessed for safety? You know, over, and this is not just in Minnesota, across the country, over the last two decades, the services, as they've shrunk in other social service agencies, have burgeoned in child welfare, so that child welfare, and I say that very specifically, child welfare, becomes this much bigger service entity versus child protection, mm-hmm. which is very rooted in safety, and it's a very narrow, much more narrow scope. Mm-hmm. This body, as I read the bill and it's written, is about child protection. So I do think that they're going to hear things and they're going to parking lot and come up with recommendations about prevention and areas where different parts of the system can act. But this, in as I read it, is focused on the child protection system and how it is working and where there's gaps and where it's not working.
Rep Hansen?
I'm good.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Vice Chair. And question, is there, I'm reading through this, you see at least one member from here, two members from there, and then, you know, further on, starting at 1.15, it just says members or professionals or professionals. And is there maybe it was stated, how many people are supposed to be on this council, or is it just kind of open-ended?
Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Madam. Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Nelson. This is written deliberately quite general, right? We, you know, to have the Supreme Court have the flexibility to kind of put something together that works the best way possible, and even maybe changing over time. So, I mean, it's sort of a feature, not a bug, you know, that it is that generality. And so, you know, often if we're establishing the task force, we're going to say the exact number of people, but then I kind of feel like along the way, you kind of say, I kind of wish we'd kind of be able to move this around or that around. So that's why it's written in general terms, and we're providing a lot of flexibility and a fair amount of responsibility as well. So,
Rep. Nelson.
Thank you for that. And you know, I think one of the things of anytime we get a committee or a task force or anything like that, there gets to be a balance point of whether it's too small or too big. Too big, it doesn't, you know, both of them are ineffective.
Right.
And I think I can understand the point there of really trying to make it right-sized and the flexibility and thank you for the being allowed to ask the question.
You don't have to thank me. Remember, you always get an opportunity to ask a question. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, this discussion set me up nicely. I'm just, again, looking at the legislative membership here. Mm-hmm. And having been on committees that are both too small and too large, I appreciate the need to control it. But I think it probably would be worth considering one member each appointed by the Speaker and Minority Leader and Senate Majority Leader and Minority Leader. Just not only because I think the import of this work sort of demands that bipartisan representation, but also because the way it's written now, I would imagine there would be bipartisan representation, but it would not be required. So there is the possibility exists, for example, if one party controls the House and the other the Senate, that the respective Speaker and Minority Leader would end up appointing the same party, right? So I think that's worth considering, and I don't know that, given that there is no sort of requirement of size, I don't know that two more members makes a hugely significant difference. So I would just make that suggestion.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and to the Chair Keeler's point earlier about that, and yours as well, Representative Coulter, I do see your point. If the Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader don't agree on who they're going to appoint, it also gets a little confusing. So I see the point that you both have made on that. Thank you. Yeah.
Any other member discussion? Seeing none, I do just want to make one comment. 2.11, 2.12 talks about a person with lived experience. We've seen this in other places, especially when their lived experience is trauma, really gross, yucky parts of their life that we're asking for them to put on display for our professional advancement. We really have to make sure that we compensate them appropriately for their time, but also you have to think of the power dynamic that sits in that room and that space, making sure that you really allow space for the individual with lived experience to share. Because when you're at a table in that role with a room full of professionals, especially the professionals that you've listed, it can be rather intimidating. So please just take that into consideration so that the individual with lived experience actually has an opportunity to be valuable in this space as well. So thank you. I should stop going off script. Chair Pinto, final words on your bill.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Chair and members. And this feels like the work that we should be doing, right, as we take a look at a good idea. I feel it's a good idea. I think you all did too. But then conversation and questions to make it better. So thank you, Chair, and thanks, members.
Thanks. So House File 4727, as amended, will be laid over.
Okay. And then I think one more bill.
Yep. Are you? So next up, we're going to do House File 3689. It's a Rep. Hassan bill, but today we're going to have Representative Hansen presenting as the chair gets settled.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for stepping in for Representative Hassan. And so Representative Hansen moves House File 3689 for placement on the General Register, and there's the A2 Author's Amendment. And as I understand, the A2 was developed in consultation with DHS, just taking into account some technical assistance that the agency has. And I should note that House File 3689 was before the committee previously. We were not sure, I think, about a cost and also some of these technical issues. Found out there's not a cost, and then the technical issues are addressed in the A2. So, Representative Hansen, you're moving the A2 amendment, yes?
Yes, Chair.
Okay. Any discussion to the A2 amendment, members? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Bill is amended. And Representative Hansen, I don't know if you go for it, Representative Hansen, on Representative Hassan's bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for allowing me to step in for Representative Hassan today. I really appreciate that. The House File 3689 is a development from the 2022 Office of Legislative Auditor Report on child protection removals and reunifications. This is a recommendation from that work asking us to create a simple and easy to understand summary for parents and so they know what the reunification plan is. We know that these documents can sometimes be 15 to 30 or more pages long, especially for folks with large families, and that can be really overwhelming as folks are trying to determine what they need to do and what steps they need to take in order to reach that reunification goal that we all have in mind. And so that's what the bill is before you. Again, the amendment, as the chair said, reflects the consultation with the department, making sure that this is cost neutral and implementable. I can tell you that I've heard stories from workers, both in my SSIS work and more, that these documents will be a guiding document to guide through the larger document. And I think that's important to note. These are not replacing the existing documents or reunification plans that exist. This would essentially serve as maybe a table of contents or a one-pager, like all of us legislators love to get from our advocates out in the community. So I think that's important. We know that the easy-to-understand piece of it is important as well. We've found that a lot of these documents contain legalese that are not a first language for a lot of us, and so making sure these are done in an easy-to-understand format is important as well. And with that, Chair, I will turn it back to you for any questions.
Thank you. And a consummate professional, as always, Representative Hansen, you were like, who, nobody would know it was not your bill. So we previously had public testimony on this bill, or previously had the opportunity for that, so we won't do that. At this time, Representative Nelson, you're up.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for presenting this bill. Representing, maybe, is the correct word. I'm not sure. So anyway, you know, and I think as we look through and understand it, I think it's a, you know, really having a summary of it, you know, much like we have our bill summaries, and really understanding what there is. I visited a little bit with our director of in Pine County, and, you know, they were, she and a couple others were talking about how do we, can we already do this? And she actually sent me a redacted plan for a, you know, out of home placement, and you said, you know, on page, it would start on page 6 of this plan, but that was really kind of the steps of here is to get your children back to be reunited as a family. Here's the kind of the steps. Now, is so the question, I guess my question is this really a plan of here's overall the summary of the full plan, or is this here's the cheat sheet of here or whatever, you know, the really the here's this checklist of how to get your family back, and, you know, here's the steps. Now the whole plan is right here, but, you know, here's the one page of these are in plain language, here's what you need to be doing.
Representative Hansen, or send to somebody else if you want. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And I don't know if DHS would like to just confirm this, but it is my practical understanding that this is an additional document on top of the existing plan. We're not looking to replace that very thorough and very dense plan, but providing that summary that can be used as a guiding document to walk through the whole plan, or to be, you know, it's a lot easier to carry this around in your purse than it is to carry maybe around a whole summary when you're really trying to focus on what's important and reunifying your family.
Okay. Ms. Sommerfeld, we'll let you answer question two.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, yes, we are.
And actually, sorry, you should identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I forgot. Jennifer Sommerfeld, Department of Human Services. And yes, we are looking at this as a separate document. You could certainly attach it to the out-of-home placement plan, and it would not be in SSIS the way we're looking at it right now. That's why there's no cost. So it would be an e-docs, which I can't explain, but there's documents that we provide to counties that they would be able to use as something separate.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and Ms. Sommerfeld. I'm also wondering, you know, as we're looking at, you know, the updating and the revamping of the SSIS system, is this also going to be something that could be maybe the auto-populating, or, you know, is this something that would be available or possible with the revamping of the system, or is it something we can look at to be able to, and part of the changes that are coming, being able to really make a simplistic plan. I mean, with, you know, with AI and everything that we have available, you know, is this something that is, you know, I don't want to make more work for our county individuals. At the same time, I really understand the, you know, the need from parents. I mean, this is probably some of the, you know, and the children too. You know, many of them are going through some of the worst days of their life. when this is happening, and to be able to give them some surety of, all right, here's a simple one page that you know, these are the nuts and bolts of what this plan is. Now the whole document is right here that you do need. Is that, you know, with changing the SSI system, is this something that's able to be generated within that?
Ms. Summerfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. So I'm not an IT person, so I can't say exactly how it would work, but in fact, that is one of our goals. As we're looking at modernization of the system, some of the things we would be looking at is making things easier for child protection caseworkers, and making sure this could autofill in some way or be generated, as you said, using AI is certainly something we would be looking at.
Representative Nelson?
Okay. Thank you.
No problem. Anybody else? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to continue off of Representative Nelson's comments, and now that we have you at our disposal, Ms. Summerfield, I just want to ask, is there any concern about the ability to effectively summarize these plans? I mean, just looking at this bill, the description of what the plan is 4 pages long. I mean, it goes from 2.9 to 6.7, and that's just describing what's in the plan. The actual plans themselves, 15 to 30 pages long. So is there any concern, or is there a level of confidence that we can produce a 1 to 2 page summary that's actually going to be effectively understood by parents?
Ms. Summerfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hudson, you're right, it is a lot of information. I think we do have some belief that we will be able to put something together, that it will not be a one-page document. It will have to be about 2 pages to make sure we have a checklist. And we've had some, I've been part of internal meetings with folks talking about the way it might be formulated would be, here's the description, you must do this, and here's the goal and reason why in a couple of very plain language sentences to make sure that folks understand, not just you must go to mental health treatment once a week with this provider or whatever it is, but what your goal is for that, for outcome. So it will also help parents that way. That's what we're envisioning.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Other questions or discussion from anybody on this? Not seeing any. So Representative Hansen, you get the final word on Representative Hassan's bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. I think obviously, this is a good bill. We know that we can help families in a better way. To Representative Nelson's point, you know, you had mentioned that Pine County said, can we already do this? And I think we have to remember that just because someone can doesn't mean that everybody will, even if we think it's the right thing to do, until we pass a bill like this. And so I applaud them for wanting to take the steps to do that. And I'm glad that there are some counties who are maybe doing this for some of their clients. But I would like to see this as a statewide mandate, so that way every family that interacts with this system has the opportunity to have this summary document. So extend my thanks to Pine County staff for going above and beyond. And with that, Chair, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you. And our thanks to you, Representative Hansen, for applying your expertise in this area to this bill. So with that, Representative Hansen renews her motion that House File 3689, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. And then, members, just final thoughts here. So we do not have committee on Thursday because of the break for Eid. We then next week, I do anticipate that there will be a budget bill. I'll be advancing a budget proposal for the committee's consideration. Hope to get that out as early in the week as possible. Of course, have a presentation and public testimony, and then amendments, if any, and then voted out on Thursday. Are there questions the members have about kind of the process? And then after that, we, of course, would be done with regular meetings for this committee, barring any kind of informational or something special coming up. Any question anybody has about any of that? Not seeing any. So we'll see you then a week from today. Certainly please be in touch. With that, the committee is adjourned.